Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court.
Would you, I think there's two, pull the microphone a little bit closer to you. Good. Thank you.
John Griffiths for plaintiff appellant. I'd like to reserve a couple minutes for a rebuttal, if I may. The sole question here is whether Arizona's open and obvious doctrine operates as a categorical bar at the pleading stage. And under Perez v. Circle K, the answer is no, whether the district court frames it as duty or breach.
This case was disposed of as on motion to dismiss, was it not?
That's correct, a 12B6 motion.
And so I guess the question is whether you stated a plausible claim, because it strikes me that it's not clear on the face of your complaint. The open and obvious doctrine might apply, but the real question is whether or not on the face of your complaint you failed to state a claim.
Now, our contention, and I think the district court agreed with us that our complaint was well pled, and what part of our the details of our complaint were that the hazard wasn't a static condition, as my colleague is going to probably argue today, but that it was a dynamic situation, a chaotic situation.
But I guess what I'm trying to focus on is this. It may turn out on summary judgment or at trial that the facts establish that the absence of the chair was open and obvious and that, therefore, your client shouldn't recover. But I'm not sure that's an issue at the pleading stage.
That's correct.
But you haven't pleaded a set of facts stating it was open and obvious. You've pleaded a set of facts that say she got up and rather quickly reached back to steady herself on the chair. In the meantime, it had been pulled away. So I'm not sure that's the correct framing of the case is all that I'm saying. It may be that the doctrine will prevent you from recovery down the road because the facts you've alleged don't turn out to be the facts you can prove at trial. But the real question is whether you've alleged sufficient facts to give rise to a negligence claim.
And I believe we did, Your Honor. I think the district court and my colleague, I used the open and obvious doctrine, I think, in terms of an outdated framework that used it as a immunity bar without going into more detailed analysis about what did the pleading say. There's a lot of unanswered questions that are really the purpose for discovery. And so our contention is that just dismissing it out of hand in a 12B6 posture is premature because, as you say, discovery may reveal that the chair was open and obvious or the circumstances around its removal were such. But we aren't able to get to that point. We don't have the benefit of knowing those facts. And it's interesting that I think both the district court and my colleague use assumptions to come to their conclusions. And those assumptions are based on facts really that we don't know the answer to or not because we haven't reached that stage in the process.
Your client was present through all this. So although you say that discovery is needed, I mean, she was there. She should know what was actually said. She knows the history of how this has been done in the past and that it was done in the past. None of that is in the complaint, but it could be. I mean, I understand that the complaint wasn't dismissed for failure to state a plausible claim with regard to detail, but there is a great deal of detail missing in terms of what you would need to determine whether there was, in fact, a breach of duty here.
And I think you raise a good point, Your Honor, because we asked for in the alternative for us to be able to have leave to amend, and that was also denied.
And the district court seems to suggest it would be futile to amend?
Apparently so, Your Honor.
I mean, he didn't state the exact exact reason, but it seems to me that's the only possible one.
Agreed.
Also, one of the things I wondered in terms of what more detail might reveal is that the complaint says the defendant's representatives instructed attendees to remove their chairs and store them. Again, there's no quote as to what was said, but the suggestion is that each person was supposed to remove their own chair. Now, again, if that was spelled out further, you would have a much stronger case.
And yes, I think we do agree with that position. If we did have leave as an alternative relief to amend, we have been, I think, made aware of additional facts since the inception of this case that we could amend the pleading to allege more specificity.
But I gather that the defendants have never taken the position here that they're somehow not responsible for what these attendees did when they were told to remove the chairs. They agree that this is the court, that this was done on behalf of the church and that the church was responsible for it.
I believe so, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question about your negligent infliction of emotional distress claim? The district court dismissed because it didn't think you appropriately pleaded negligence. Assuming that you did for a moment, I'm having trouble reading the complaint even liberally as alleging that the emotional distress led to a physical injury or physical manifestation. There's lots of physical injuries alleged, but I just don't find the allegation that the physical manifestations or injuries resulted from the emotional distress as opposed to just hitting the ground. Assuming that the complaint doesn't sufficiently allege that, do you claim that you could sufficiently allege it if given the opportunity to amend?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, we've been made aware of additional facts since the inception of the case that we could add that detail into the complaint.
I've read it. Maybe I misread it, and I'd be interested in your reaction. But I just don't find the linkage that the NIAD law requires in Arizona between the emotional distress and the physical manifestation of it.
And I think we would be concede your question about that. There is definitely, I think, room to amend. As I say, we have been made aware of additional facts.
You seem to be claiming injuries that resulted in Utah from treatment in Utah or Nevada, I forget which one, the subsequent church that she attended. Are those really proximately caused by the negligence of the folks in Chandler?
But that's our contention, Your Honor. The second accident, or the second injury, I should say, rather, occurred in close proximity to the first while our client was under a heavy amount of pain medicine and essentially trying to treat for the first.
Wouldn't that in itself have a proximate cause problem? I mean, it was a month later. And it was, you know, causally connected, I suppose, to her earlier injury, but it wasn't actually due to the injury as such. It was due to, as you contend, her the medication she was under and so on. So it just seems that there are too many steps between the original injury and whatever caused her second fall a month later.
And I think we would agree that there is some distance between both injuries.
Yeah, and I guess I was focusing on the fact that people were mean to her at the second church and belittled her and stuff. Can you, are those really proximately caused by her injuries?
Well, what I would really say about
the judge didn't dismiss on that basis. Yeah, so I don't know that it makes much of a difference to that, but it just struck me as a little bit.
What I would say in response to that question and perhaps some of these previous questions is really a lot of this could be further fleshed out in discovery. I mean, we have a limited set of facts that we've tried to allege with specificity, but we have a whole, you know, universe of available, you know, subpoena power, depositions, and so on and so forth. We haven't been afforded that opportunity. So be as it may.
As to the second injury, I'm not sure what good discovery would do you. As to the people being mean to her in Utah, I mean, I suppose you might be able to demonstrate that there was some direct communication between the people in Utah and the people in where they said, you know, this person's terrible, I'll be mean to her or something like that. But or she's suing us or she's complaining about us. Maybe you could find something like that. Seems, I don't know. I don't know if that would do it. But as to the second, I'm more concerned about the second injury because I don't see, you know, anything that would tie it in sufficiently, no matter what the discovery showed.
And again, I think, Your Honor, we would concede that there is some amount of distance between the two injuries. Our contention is that they are connected because were it not for the first injury, she wouldn't have suffered the second.
But in any event, it's not in front of us whether you claim too much in damages.
That's correct.
What's in front of us is whether you stated a claim for the initial arising out of this incident at the Chandler Church.
Correct. I would love to continue to make that opportunity to argue to the district court judge at a later date. But we need an opportunity to go back and to continue this case.
Well, counsel, Judge Gould, I would like to interject a question to try to clarify something in my mind. To claim emotional distress damages, there has to be some physical injury first, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Although I think cognitive and mental anguish, I think, can qualify under that standard.
Okay.
In Arizona?
Also, my question is, if she was injured from the fall itself, her initial fall, had some physical injury from that, wouldn't you be able to claim emotional distress damages? She doesn't have to. Stated in another way.
I'm following you, Your Honor. Yes, and I agree. The emotional distress could follow from the physical injury. No question.
And she doesn't need to necessarily have a resulting physical injury from the emotional distress in order to get those damages if she was injured in the fall.
I would agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
You wanted to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes. Thank you.
I hate to say let's hear from the church, so let's hear from the defendant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Christopher Bates for the defendant, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Based on the pleaded facts in the complaint, the alleged hazard here was open and obvious as a matter of law.
I want to push back on that. Because I think that's the reason the district court dismissed the complaint. The facts in the complaint seem to say, or certainly are subject to a plausible reading, that I stood up, I'm an elderly person, and it is reasonable for an elderly person when they're standing up to steady themselves on the chair, and it was yanked out from under me. And I think that doesn't, those facts as alleged don't make it clear that the danger was open and obvious. It may well be those facts are wrong. It may well be that it was 7 minutes before, and she saw them collecting lots of chairs before that and just didn't pay attention. But as alleged, which is all we can deal with, why do those facts establish as a matter of law that the danger was open and obvious?
She pleaded that this was a customary routine directive that happened at the end of every meeting. This was a regular occurrence, this instruction.
But was it a regular occurrence for them to take out the chair immediately after somebody stood up?
Well, her claim is that the negligence was the instruction, not the removal of the chair. She claims that it was the instruction that created a foreseeable
unfold. But she's really claiming it was a lack of instruction. I mean, that is that the instructions were insufficiently detailed and didn't say but you know, watch out and don't do it until somebody has actually left or gotten up or whatever. But I have the same question I asked your opponent, which is what she actually says is that they instructed the attendees to remove their chairs and remove them and store them. So could that be understood as saying each person is supposed to remove their chair and not supposed to go around removing other people's chairs?
That's that is how she phrases it, Your Honor. But she also doesn't plead that she was surprised by the fact that a different person had removed her chair. If, in fact, it were uncommon for somebody else to remove their neighbor's chair, she could have pleaded that. But she didn't plead that she was surprised that somebody else besides herself had had removed her chair. She pleaded
that
this
was... Do you make a motion that this complaint was inadequate under Twombly and Iqbal as insufficiently detailed to state a plausible claim?
I'm sorry, what was the first part of your question, Your Honor?
Asking whether you ever argued in the motion to dismiss that this was an inadequately pled complaint because insufficiently detailed under Iqbal and Twombly.
I'll ask my colleague to confirm, but I don't believe that we made the argument that it failed under Iqbal and Twombly. I think that our argument was that based on the pleaded facts, it was open and obvious as a matter of law, and therefore for that reason, there was not a viable negligence claim.
What you seem to be arguing today is that she failed to negate in her pleadings the fact that it might have been open and obvious. And I'm trying to figure out where the burden falls on that. That strikes me as you don't have to say in a pleading something occurred and the danger wasn't open and obvious. The question is whether the pleadings, if believed, establishes a matter of law that the danger was open and obvious. So how do I get that out of these pleadings?
So I think that you're correct, Honor, that what we're arguing and how the district court approached this was the second half of what you said there, was that based on the pleadings themselves established that it was open and obvious, and it was because it was a customary routine directive, it was a regular occurrence, and therefore she knew that when she stood up that the chair would be removed.
But did she know that?
What she actually said was as she began to rise, she reached for her chair. So she, as pledged, she didn't actually even stand up.
It's unclear from her pleading exactly how quickly the chair was removed. That's certainly correct, Your Honor. Based on the pleading, there was at least some time disjuncture between when she began rising and when she reached back. That is to say, she wasn't holding it, you know, from the second she began rising. There was some time disjuncture between when she began to stand up and when the chair was removed.
But the complaint doesn't plead. I understood that they would take the chair out from under you immediately after you stood up. If it said that, I'd understand your open and obvious point. But it just said, I knew that there was a custom of removing the chairs. Mm-hmm. But she seems to be arguing in this case that custom was carried out in a negligent manner because it was done so soon after she stood up that's what caused her fall.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, Your Honor, the claim is that the church was negligent not in the removal of the chair. It was negligent in issuing an instruction without appropriate supervision, training, guidelines, et cetera. In other words, that the instruction was not detailed enough in providing instructions to the other attendees. And, you know, it's not a perfect analogy, but the cases that we see where the court applies the open and obvious doctrine, it's a case where somebody's at a gas station, there's a trench at the gas station, they can see the trench, they know that it's there, they proceed forward, they fall into it, notwithstanding they can see it. It's open and obvious, and so therefore they can be expected to take precautions to protect themselves. Here, similarly, because she heard the instruction, it was routine, it was a regular occurrence, she knew that when she stood, her chair would be removed, and therefore she could
I asked a different question. Right. I'm sorry if I didn't ask it precisely enough. Did she allege that she knew that it was routine that the chair would be removed quite promptly after she stood up? Well, I mean, I understand that the chairs would be removed, but mm-hmm. doesn't she have some right to expect that she can get up and be steady before the chair is removed?
I mean, she alleges that it was a routine directive.
That's not what I asked.
Directive.
I asked, does she allege that I understood that it would be that the chairs would be removed instantaneously after I got up?
No, she has not alleged that. But
also, I'm going back to the fact that she didn't even say it happened after she got up. She said, as she began to ride, she reached back. So her allegation is that she wasn't, hadn't gotten up. She was in the process of getting up.
It's not entirely clear, Your Honor. That's correct. In paragraph one, she says that when
clear that's what she said.
That in paragraph one, she says when she began to rise to comply. In that later paragraph, Your Honor just read from, she says as she began to rise. There was at least some time disjuncture between when she began to rise and when she placed her hand on the chair. The chair wasn't ripped out from under her while her hand was on it. There was some period in between when she began to rise and when she went to push her hand
back.
But
the complaint is susceptible of a reading that said this occurred relatively shortly after I began to rise.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
And if that's true, then how could the danger have been open and obvious?
Because it was a customary routine.
So was there a routine to yank chairs out from under people as they begin to rise?
Well, but again, Your Honor, her claim is that the negligence was not in the removal of the chair. Her claim is that the negligence was in the issuance of instruction.
Let's assume that for a moment that the local church, I'm sure this didn't come from anywhere else, said, you got to get those chairs out from under those people as soon as they begin to rise because we are on a tough time schedule. That would be bad instruction, wouldn't it?
I would agree that could certainly create foreseeable risks. Yes, but as to open and obvious, even in that instant, she would have been on notice that as she began to rise, her chair could be removed from under her, and therefore, if she had reason to expect that she might have difficulty rising, that she could take precautions to protect herself. That's the nub of the open and obvious doctrine.
Counsel, let me interject a question. I understood your example that if someone sees a ditch that's visible, that can be open and obvious. They should not stumble into it. But how can a person yanking a chair away or taking a chair away while a person's either rising or starting to sit down, how could that be open and obvious? It wasn't visible to her eyes that someone would do something in the future that would cause that. So I have a problem with your obvious contention because of the timing. I don't see how she could have seen that would happen before it happened. So unless she's clairvoyant, which no one's contending.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. The key point is that she knew that the chair would be removed when she stood because of the instruction. So it wasn't visual. It was that she heard the instruction and therefore knew because of the instruction that her chair would be removed. And therefore, if she had reason to expect that she might have difficulty standing, she was on notice that her chair would be removed, and therefore she could have waited a little longer to stand. She could have put her hand back at the exact second that she began standing.
What was the instruction? I interrupted Judge Gould. Go ahead.
And why would that not be a matter for a summary judgment motion where it's decided on facts? And you could put in an affidavit saying that it was obvious when she started to rise, and opposing it, there could be an affidavit or declaration from the plaintiff saying why it's not obvious. Then a court would have to decide if there was a genuine issue of material fact raised. But I have trouble right now, and that's why I wanted to give you a chance to respond with seeing this as open and obvious.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, it's not visual in the same way that the trench example is, but she heard the instructions, so therefore she understood that when she stood, her chair would be removed. And the key to the open and obvious doctrine is that when
she said it wasn't when she stood. She said it was as she began to rise.
Well, yes, Your Honor. And so if she had reason to expect that she might have difficulty standing, this is the key of the open and obvious doctrine, is that when,
as she began to rise, she reached for her chair. So why does a directive that you say would be reasonably understood as saying when somebody gets up, take their chair, which I don't even know if it's true because it actually says that they're supposed to remove their chairs. But if that was true, she says it happened that she reached for her chair as she began to rise. That's what she says. That your position is inconsistent with the alleged facts.
Well, Your Honor, when you look at the complaint, there is some time disjuncture between when she began to rise and when she put her hand back. It may have been that it was a brief amount of time.
That's not what she says. She says, as she began to rise, she reached for her chair.
Yes, so...
As she began to rise, she reached for her chair.
Yes, so she had lifted herself at least some distance off the chair. It doesn't say, you know, she put her hand back and then rose. It says that she began to rise first and then put her hand back. So it may be a brief amount of time.
She wasn't standing up in the way that somebody could think that she was actually out of the chair. In any event, I have a separate question.
Okay.
What is your position on the motion to amend? What possible justification is there for not allowing an amendment here?
So from this court...
Given our case law, which is extremely permissive about amendments.
Well, this court's case law also says, Your Honor, that a district court does not abuse its discretion in denying leave to amend where the plaintiff doesn't state what additional facts they would have offered. We moved to dismiss with prejudice. In her opposition, she didn't proffer facts that she would have added or attached an amended complaint. Even now on appeal, she has suggested potential subjects that she could proffer facts on about how quickly it was removed, the density of the congregation. But she hasn't said what those facts actually are. And so under this court's case law, it's not an abuse of discretion to deny leave to amend when the plaintiff hasn't actually proffered to the court what those actual facts are.
And finally, I take it you don't take any issue with the notion that the church is responsible for what the congregants did. Well, for the directive, if it was insufficiently, if it was a negligent directive with regard to what the congregants were to do. Is that how you would phrase it?
For purposes of our motion below here on appeal, we've accepted the facts as pled. We're not.
And you've accepted the fact that the church could be responsible if a congregant pursuant to this directive pulled a chair out negligently.
So again, the negligence claim is the instruction. If she had pleaded negligence based on the removal and that the church was responsible for a parishioner removing, we might have contested that. Her claim is that a church leader gave the instruction.
But couldn't the complaint be amended? I mean, it seems to me in this case that even in the absence of an instruction, it might be negligent for an agent of the church, the guy stacking up the chairs, to pull away the chair so quickly. So isn't the complaint at least susceptible of a reading that with amendment would state a claim?
I think, again, we've not briefed this because this is not how they presented the claim. If she were to claim that a fellow parishioner removing a chair in doing so was acting as an agent of the church, I think that we probably would contest that.
Would you, even if they had been instructed by the church to remove the chairs?
Well, so the question, Your Honor...
nobody doubts that the church instructed these people, whoever they were, to fellow parishioners, to remove the chairs. So they were plainly acting on behalf of the church in doing that, weren't they?
Yeah, so the question, Your Honor, would be, a church or a school, whatever organization we want to come up with, if they ask the attendees to remove the chairs, do the attendees then become the agents of the organization in removing the chairs? I don't know what the case law says on that off the top of my head. I would think there probably could be reasons that we would have to argue that agency doesn't extend that far, but that's obviously not what's been pleaded here.
Fair enough. I think we've taken you over.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
We appreciate the argument. And Mr. Griffiths, you have a little bit of time for rebuttal.
I really don't have much to add other than what's been argued, Your Honors. If there are any other follow-up questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I did want to mention with regard to the church's contention that this was a routine operation and so on and so forth. I think that can also cut in favor of our position that there is foreseeability. And the church should have known that these circumstances created an opportunity or hazards could have been foreseeable because of the...
The motion to amend and the fact that you haven't proffered any specific allegations?
Well, I don't know if I can speak specifically to our request for relief in that circumstance. I know that if we are granted that opportunity to amend, that we can...
Pleading, it says we think we've stated a claim, but judge, if you don't think so, let us amend.
Yes.
You didn't say because we would add, now knowing what their problem is with your complaint, because we would add the following facts, did you?
No, but you know, I guess hindsight is 20/20, and going through this process, but certainly,
counsel, Judge Gould with a question for you on this amendment issue. Has the complaint ever been previously amended once, or was the operative complaint the complaint initially filed?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that again, Your Honor?
Was the complaint that was dismissed here with the dismissal on appeal, was that the original complaint that was filed? Or had it ever been amended previously?
And I don't know the answer to that offhand, Your Honor. There is a possibility that it could have been amended. Offhand, I don't think that it had been. I think this was the complaint as it was filed.
The complaint that's in the record is called complaint. It's not called First Amendment complaint or anything else.
I don't have any recollection of making it.
And I can't find any order in the record where the judge granted leave to amend or any indication that you just amended within the time period allowed by law.
As far as I know, I don't think we were ever we never did amend or had that opportunity.
Okay, but the reason I asked my question was in some other cases, I think I've seen authorities saying there's a more liberal standard to permit amendment if it's the first amendment of a complaint that a court's going to dismiss.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you. I think, again, to my recollection, and I think as the record shows, this is our original complaint. We would appreciate the opportunity to be able to amend to add specificity. And I think that should be granted to us, Your Honors.
Yeah, well, I'm speaking just for myself. I'm personally inclined to think a complaint should be liberally granted. Amendment should be liberally granted after a first complaint, after the initial complaint is dismissed. But your friend on the other side of the case should comment in a rebuttal on that.
And again, I am in agreement. And I would welcome a rebuttal from my colleague in that circumstance in front of the district court.
Other questions from my colleagues? If not, this case will be submitted with thanks to both sides for their briefing and argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.